We ought to be. We ain't what we're going to be. But thank God, we ain't what we was. Thank you.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., speaking in London at City Temple on December 7, 1964, he would receive the Nobel Peace Prize 3 days later in Oslo, Norway. The recording of this speech was recently discovered by Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives. To get a copy of today's show and to learn more about how this rare King recording was discovered, go to our website at democracynow.org. The Pacifica Radio Archives website is pacificaradioarchives.org. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Amy Littlefield, Renee Feltz, Aaron Maté, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Prude, and Vesta Gadars. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Carlo De Jesus, and Jose Miranda. I'm Amy Goodman. This is democracynow.org.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
The World Arts Foundation Incorporated and KBOO would like to invite you to its 32nd annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 16th, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center, located at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Invited guests will include a multitude of speakers and performances that includes the Portland Interfaith Gospel Choir and choirs from the Portland Public Schools, African drumming, and the acclaimed Jefferson Dancers, and much, much more. Monday, January 16th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., live right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Keep alive the dream.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the opening reception of Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. This event was originally scheduled for Friday, January 13th. Giving Back illustrates Black philanthropic experiences and giving traditions grounded in faith, mutuality, responsibility, and social justice. Images and stories are from the book Giving Back, a tribute to generations of African-American philanthropists. Again, that's the opening reception of Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, Reframed and Exhibited, Friday, January 20th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland, good morning. It's 8:02. More Talk Radio is off for the holiday, but we have a couple of presentations. This first half hour between 8 and 8:30 is a show called Making Contact, and then following that, Dismantling Racism. It's 8:02. This is KBOO.
I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact.
Will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
It's one of the most famous speeches of all time, and it nearly didn't happen.
Wyatt T. Walker says to King, don't do the I have a dream thing. It's trite, it's a cliche, you've used it too many times before.
But on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. ignored that advice. In front of what was then the largest civil rights demonstration the Capitol had ever seen, he did the I have a dream thing.
Black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
On this edition of Making Contact, Gary Young talks about his book, The Speech, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream and the Story Behind It.
The book is called The Speech, and it's about King's famous speech at the March on Washington. And if left there as an idea, then you have a great man and a great talk. But King could not do that on its own. The speech and the march came from somewhere. I want to start by giving some context to that text, because in the absence of that, there would have been no march and there would have been no speech.
Hey, we're in the middle of a revolution, because I see the face of things to come. Yes, I do.
And so I start with kind of some of the people whose names perhaps we don't know, but who paid for that speech in a range of ways. And I begin with Franklin McCain, who was a 17-year-old in Greensboro, North Carolina, who made his stand by taking his seat at the Woolworths downtown on February the 1st, 1960. When I interviewed Franklin McCain, he said that up until that time, as a young man in North Carolina, he felt that his life was worthless and that his parents had lied to him. And the lie that they told him was a great American lie, that you can be anything you want to be. And he said, as he grew through adolescence, he knew that wasn't true. As a 17-year-old black male in North Carolina, he knew that that wasn't true. And just as a symbol of how untrue that was, a completely different story that I was doing, several years later, I interviewed a guy called Buford Posey from Mississippi, a white guy who became an anti-racist, who told me quite kind of matter-of-factly, he said, I never knew that it was illegal to kill a black man until I joined the army. He said, until that time, I knew it was wrong, but I didn't know it was illegal. And true enough, in Mississippi, the people who were as likely as not to be killing black people were actually the law enforcement agencies. So it was not an entirely incredible thing for him to think. So if we go back to Franklin McCain, he knows this as well as Buford Posey does. And he says he was angry at his parents for this lie. And so they sat up, him and his friends, late into the night, January 31st, talking about how everybody had failed them before they talked themselves into the action that they took the following day, not knowing when they showed up at Woolworths in Greensboro whether any of the others would be there. He says, we wanted to go beyond what our parents had done, and the worst thing that could happen was that the Klan could kill us. But I had no concern for my personal safety. The day I sat at that counter, I had the most tremendous feeling of elation and celebration. I felt that in this life, nothing else mattered. If there's a heaven, I got there for a few minutes. I just felt you can't touch me. You can't hurt me. And celebration. I felt that in this life, nothing else mattered. If there's a heaven, I got there for a few minutes. I just felt you can't touch me. You can't hurt me. There's no other experience like it, not even the birth of my first child. A few years later, in May 63, in Birmingham, Alabama, a burly white police officer attempted to intimidate some black school children to keep them from joining the growing anti-segregation protests. They assured him they knew what they were doing, ignored his entreaties, and continued their march toward Kelly Ingram Park, where they were arrested. A reporter asked one of them her age. 6, she said, as she climbed into the paddy wagon. The following month in Mississippi, stalwart civil rights campaigner Fannie Lou Hamer overheard Annell Ponder, a fellow activist, being beaten in jail in an adjacent cell. Can you say yes, sir, nigger? Can you say yes, sir, the policeman demanded. Yes, I can, replied Ponder. So say it. I don't know you well enough, said Ponder. And then Hamer heard her head hit the floor again. The Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuscinski once wrote, all books about all revolutions begin with a chapter that describes the decay of tottering authority or the misery and sufferings of the people. But they should begin with a psychological chapter, one that shows how a harassed, terrified man suddenly breaks his terror and stops being afraid. This unusual process demands illuminating. Man gets rid of fear and feels free. The period preceding King's speech at the March on Washington was one such chapter. Until that point, there had, of course, been many fearless acts by anti-racist protesters. But in that moment, the number who were prepared to commit them reached a critical mass. In May 63, the New York Times published more stories about civil rights in 2 weeks than it had in the previous 2 years. During the 10-week period following Kennedy's address on civil rights in June that year, there were 758 demonstrations in 186 cities, resulting in 14,733 arrests. Such were the conditions that made the March on Washington possible and King's speech so resonant. And this context was global. 2 days after McCain made his protest in Greensboro, the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan addressed the South African Parliament in Cape Town with an ominous warning.
The wind of change is blowing through this continent. And whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact.
Some, including his immediate audience and apartheid parliament, didn't like it at all. But as a decade wore on, that wind became a gale. In the 3 years between Macmillan's speech and the March on Washington, the following countries became independent. Togo, Mali, Senegal, Zaire, Somalia, Benin, Niger, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Chad, Central African Republic, Congo, Gabon, Nigeria, Mauritania, Sierra Leone, Tanganyika, and Jamaica. Internationally, non-racial democracy and the black enfranchisement that came with it were the order of the day. The longer America practiced legal segregation, the more it looked like a slum on the wrong side of history than a shining city on the hill. Now, the story of that year in particular is the story of the base, the masses, the grassroots continually running ahead of the leadership. King spoke in Harlem just a few months before the march and was heckled by protesters shouting, "We want Malcolm." When the NAACP hold their conference in Chicago, they invite Mayor Daley to give introductory remarks, and he is heckled from the floor. When their leaders go to speak to Kennedy about holding the march, Kennedy says to them, "We have legislation that's currently going through Congress. We would rather have new laws than have the Negroes out on the streets." And A. Philip Randolph, the socialist and trade union organizer who's primarily responsible for calling the march, tells Kennedy, "The Negroes are already in the streets, Mr. President, and I doubt if you called them that they would come back." That is the mood of the moment, that the patience has worn out, the forbearance, the ability to withstand the clubs and the hoses that can fire so strong they can knock the bark off a tree at 30 feet being fired at children and dogs, has become too much. And so African Americans, who are always fighting back, start to resist like with like. In Birmingham, there is, eventually, they respond to the bombings of the Klan with violence. And there's a fear, both among the civil rights leadership and among the Kennedy administration, that black people will resist and will meet like with like. That is the mood that creates a necessity for a march, which is called at the beginning of the year, but very few people want. The polls show that most Americans don't want it, and particularly most white Americans don't want it. Kennedy doesn't want it. It's insufficiently radical for many of the youth and too radical for many of the more conservative leadership. But by the time it happens, there is a sense that if they don't do this, then what are they going to do to channel this frustration, this mass frustration? And so the march happens. Now, the key fear, primarily of the state, is that there will be violence. This is peculiar because most of the violence in the South has come from the white segregationists, not from African Americans. But nonetheless, the fear is that there will be violence, and so it is literally policed as a military operation. It's called Operation Steep Hill. 82nd Airborne, ready to fly up from North Carolina at a moment's notice and drop 19,000 troops on D.C. 1,000 troops in D.C. Deployed, 6,000 police working, all leave cancelled, all elective surgery cancelled, baseball game cancelled, alcoholic sales are made illegal. And even on the mic that King speaks from, there is a kill switch that the Justice Department put in surreptitiously. The idea is that if anybody calls for insurrection from the stage, that they will flip the switch and play Mahalia Jackson singing, "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands." That's their response. And so, it is into that into that atmosphere that King plans his address. Now, King gave around 350 speeches that year. So if you take time off for high days and holidays, that's about a speech a day. And generally, he's not giving a bespoke speech. He's an African-American Baptist preacher. And in that tradition, he drafts his sermon, but then he crafts it in response to how the audience is taking to what he's saying. And he has a number of a series of weapons that he can use, rhetorical weapons. But the difference is that this speech, unlike other speeches, is going to be televised. If you're in a black church or the civil rights movement, you'd heard King speak before. But if you weren't, this was his oratorical introduction to the nation. Kennedy had never heard him give a speech before. And at the end of the speech, he turns to one of his aides in the Oval Office and says, "Damn, he's good." And so King and his team want something that is going to be on a par with Gettysburg. Now, we know a lot of these details because the FBI were kind enough to record them for us. He wants something on a par with Gettysburg. And so one of his main aides, Wyatt T. Walker, says to King, "Don't do the I Have a Dream thing. It's trite. It's a cliche. You've used it too many times before." And that's the first line of the book. And indeed, King had used it many times before. He first recorded using of it was in 62. It's thought that he probably used it in 61. That's a couple of years before. He'd used it in June at a rally in Detroit. And even a week earlier at a fundraiser for black insurance executives in Chicago. So this was not the first time that, by a long stretch, that he had used the I Have a Dream refrain. And King worries away at this speech. He seeks counsel. He has a lot of input, much more than he would generally. And what we know is that when he goes to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning of the march, "I Have a Dream" is not in the text of the speech that we know. And according to Clarence Jones, his lawyer and his speechwriter, it was not in King's mind to do that the next day. So the next day, there is a series of meetings they have with Congress. There's a funny kind of moment at the beginning of the day where they're in meeting Congress, and they come out, and the march has started without them, very symbolically, given what I've said earlier. Bayard Rustin, the out gay, ex-communist, conscientious objector, and that's before you get to the fact that he's black, he's the organizer of this march, and he runs out of Congress, sees the march leaving, and says, "We are supposed to be leading them." They jump into their limousines and try to catch up with the march, but are blocked by the traffic caused by the march that they themselves have called. And so they jump out of the limousines, and they run to catch up with the march. And if you look at pictures of the leaders of the march, in a kind of Fred Flintstone version of photoshopping, what they did was basically just clear people out of the way so it looks as though they are at the front of the march, but actually they're in the middle. And throughout that day, King is worrying away at this text, scrawling all over it. If you look at the actual, what he ends up with, you know, what's left on the podium when he finishes speaking, it's full of doodles and scrawls and so on.
You're listening to Gary Young, author of The Speech on Making Contact. Special thanks to The New School for use of their recording. To find out more about the show or to download past episodes, go to radioproject.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. Up next, Gary Young explains what had to happen to turn Martin Luther King Jr. from an unpopular figure at the time of his death to the widely praised icon we know today.
I can tell from your applause he needs no further introduction. Mr. Bob Dylan.
It was a hot day, 87 degrees at noon, and King is the 16th on a agenda of 80.
Oh, the time will come up when the wind.
He's a 10th speaker. There's been the anthem, the invocation, the prayer. There have been a range of a number of singers, including Mahalia Jackson, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bob Dylan. A range of people have sung. He takes to the podium about 2:30.
At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
And according to Clarence Jones, who drafted much of the text, King keeps closer to this text than he would regularly keep.
I am happy to join with you today.
Those who wrote speeches for King said they were always King's speeches, basically. But you would be, in Clarence Jones' words, like a very crude architect. You would set up the four walls, and then King, like a beautiful interior designer, would come and he would make it his own. And King speaks very faithfully to the main text.
50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation.
But then and if you listen to the speech, and I would advise you to listen to it, it's the most popular, least well-known speech I've heard of. When I told my brother I was doing this book, he said, I love that speech. It's such a great speech. You know, that thing about I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land, and I said, it's a great speech, but it's not that speech. And he's winding up. He says, go back to Mississippi, go back to Louisiana, go back to South Carolina,
go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana, go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed.
Behind him is sitting Mahalia Jackson, a very, very close and special friend. When King was on the road, he would often call Mahalia Jackson for what they termed gospel therapy. He would call her and he would ask her to sing to him down the phone to soothe his spirit when he was down. And so he knew her well, he knew her voice well. And she shouts, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. She had heard him deliver the dream segment in June in Detroit. King continues.
Let us not wallow in the valley of despair.
And then she shouts again, tell us about the dream, Martin. Tell us about the dream.
I say to you today, my friend.
And then, in the words of Clarence Jones, King puts his text to the left of the podium, and in his body language changes from a lecturer to a preacher. And Jones turns to the person next to him and says, those people don't know him, but they're about to go to church.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
At which point, Wyatt T. Walker, the man who advised him not to do that, who's in the crowd, turns to the person next to him and says, oh, he's doing the dream. So that's how we got there. And what's interesting is that when you ask people who were there at the time and who knew King well, to a person, they will tell you that they did not, of all the speeches that he made, this was not particularly one that they thought we would be talking about in 50 years' time. It was a great speech, that none of them, you know, deny that. But many of them have different speeches that they thought were better. And either way, they said great speeches was what King did. And so I spend a fair amount of time in the book looking at why that is. And I want to kind of really suggest two things here. The first is that there is something for pretty much everybody in this speech. If you are an African American, part of a community who's told that you are genetically stupid, that you're poor because you're stupid, that your stupidity is your responsibility, and that your the failings in your community have nothing to do with history and everything to do with you, then to know that the best speech, America's favorite speech, was delivered by an African-American in the black vernacular as an indictment of American racism is something to be very proud of. If you are a patriot, there is nothing in this speech that you need worry about.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Literally and metaphorically delivered in the shadow of Lincoln, that pays homage to the founding fathers, the Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence. It's an American speech. Couldn't have come from anywhere else. If you are progressive, this speech comes on this day. There have been few days like this for American progressives. Fair enough, only 20% of the crowd was white, which was less than what they were expecting. But nonetheless, this was the first march of its kind in Washington. Now, marches in Washington are two to a penny, but this mass demonstration, they hoped for 100,000, they got 250,000. Had never been done before. And it comes, and this is the way I describe it in the book, it is the most eloquent articulation of the last great moral act that America can claim for which there is any consensus, and that is the end of American apartheid. That whatever people say now or feel able to say, nobody who wants to be taken seriously is calling for those signs to go back up. Nobody is calling for a return to formal, codified segregation. And however small that may seem when we see the amount of racism that can still spew from the mouths of those who are elected or unelected, that is no small thing. The end of apartheid is a big thing. And it's, I believe it's the last great moral thing that America can really claim to have done as a country. So there is that. A number of people have something to claim, but there's also something else. King, when he delivers that speech, there is an even number of Americans with a favorable and unfavorable view of him. By 66, twice as many Americans have an unfavorable view than a favorable view. And then he's dead in 68, assassinated. By 1999, when Americans are polled on who are their favorite characters of the 20th century, King comes second only to Mother Teresa. So something happens between when he is assassinated as a somewhat marginal and polarized figure and 1999. And this is what I think has happened. First of all, why does he become unpopular? Well, when the speech is delivered, the year after comes the Civil Rights Act. The year after that comes the Voting Rights Act. Legislation begins to kick in, and King understands that the end of segregation is not the same as the beginning of equality. As he says, I have given people, we have won the right to eat in any restaurant of our choice, but we do not have the ability to eat everything that's on the menu because we can't afford it.
There are 40 million poor people here. And one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. And you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water?
Now, that kind of talk in America in 1967 will get you killed. And sure enough, a year later, he is killed. So he starts talking about capitalism. Year after that, in 67, he starts at the Riverside Church. He calls America
the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today.
And takes a stand against the Vietnam War. Now, how is America then going to remember King? Well, it can't remember him if it's going to raise him to iconic status. If it's going to put him on the mall, then it has to sanitize him for public consumption. It has to make him the kind of person who could come second to Mother Teresa. And you can't do that with a man in America who questions capitalism. Because to remember King in that way would not raise him above the fray, it would enter him into it. You can't remember King as a man who criticized capitalism and still hold him up as an American icon. That doesn't work unless what it takes to be an American icon changes. You can't remember him. America can't remember him. The powers that be is the man who called America the greatest purveyor of military violence in the world today, because arguably it still is. And it was notable on the 50th anniversary of the speech. It took place literally on a split screen. And on one screen, there was Obama, Clinton, Carter, carrying King's mantle, cloaking themselves in his legacy. And on the other screen, will we bomb Syria? When will we bomb Syria? Why wouldn't we bomb Syria? You can't remember King as that, have him on the mall, and still claim him to be an American icon when he's speaking about America being the greatest purveyor of military violence. But you can remember him as a man who got rid of American apartheid. Not American racism, because that would involve a whole different set of conversations about why black men in D.C. have a lower life expectancy rate than men on the Gaza Strip. You can't have that conversation, but you can have the conversation about why or how he got rid of American apartheid. And so that's the way that they choose to remember him. And so I end with just one paragraph where I talk about the process by which King, and through him the speech, can be sanitized. And they say, white America, most of it, came to embrace King in the same way that most white South Africans came to accept Nelson Mandela, grudgingly and gratefully, retrospectively, selectively, without grace, but with considerable guile. By the time they realized their dislike of him was spent and futile, he'd created a world in which admiring him was in their own self-interest, because, in short, they had no choice. When it comes to King and his speech, one of the central arguments in this book is it's not just about what you remember, it's also about what you forget. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Gary Young, author of The Speech, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream and the Story Behind It, published by Haymarket Books. Special thanks to the New School for use of their recording. To find out more about Making Contact, go to radioproject.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Quan Booth, Laura Flynn, Jasmine Lopez, Lisa Rudman, and Andrew Stelzer. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact. I'm George Lavender.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets every third Thursday at 5 o'clock p.m.
From the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, and for the Pacifica Radio Network, this is Progressive Spirit, Spirituality, and Social Justice. I'm John Schock. It's now 53 years since the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racist, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
So what has happened to the dream? That's today's question. Today we are going to talk about race and racism. It is a conversation that is long overdue. White people need to recognize that racism exists, and we need to be sickened by it, and we need to dismantle it. No excuses, no pretending, no defensiveness. Where do we begin? I'm speaking in particular to white people, white like me.
Many, many white people don't understand how their skin, their white skin, gives them privileges that black people do not have. I mean, I talk to white people who came from humble beginnings, and they don't understand the concept of white privilege. But I think that because of the way we've constructed a society in this country, that if your skin is white, you have an edge, you have a step up above any person of color, and particularly black people. So one of the things that white people have to do is to begin to be more, particularly Christians, have to be more interested in being Christian than being white. And for me, that takes repentance. That takes turning yourself around, changing your mind.
Today's guest is Dr. Catherine Meeks. She's a retired professor of sociocultural studies at Wesleyan College. She's the editor of the newly released book, Living into God's Dream, Dismantling Racism in America. Her book contains chapters from 8 different contributors, including herself, some white, some people of color, some men, some women. The first chapter is written by Luther E. Smith, Jr. Dr. Smith is Professor Emeritus of Church and Community at the Candler School of Theology of Emory University. This is a paragraph that stood out for me. He began the chapter asking if racism exists. Yes. Then he asked why. He wrote that it exists because it is embedded in our history and our institutions. He writes, quote, "Centuries of racial discrimination and injustice are the foundation upon which current social and economic institutions stand," end quote. Then he wrote this, "Racism also persists because a large segment of the population benefits from it. This explains why and how individuals perpetuate the system of racism, even without their conscious awareness of the implications of their actions. The existence of racism relies upon it having the personal commitment of some and the inaction of many." End quote. I can say for a fact that I have been inactive for too long. I don't want racism to exist or to persist. I don't want to be part of the inactive problem. I want to be a part of the active solution. I think you do too. Otherwise, you wouldn't have listened to me for this long. Keep listening. My guest is committed to fostering dialogue. She says, "I keep talking about race because dialogue has to continue." Catherine Meeks is with me via phone from Atlanta. Welcome, Dr. Meeks, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
In 1963, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. 53 years have passed. What, in your opinion, has happened to the dream?
Well, in the first place, I think that speech, while it was fantastic and full of great phrases and drama. It didn't. It really was. We had a long ways to go from what he was talking about in that speech to get to the to actually get to it. And I think that in many ways we've made changes. Yes, indeed, we've made changes in this country around the relationships between blacks and whites and the status of black people. But we didn't make the kinds of changes at the very core in our society that needed to be made so that we wouldn't find ourselves in 2017 having to deal with the kind of polarization and spirits of discord that we see currently. So, I think it's a funny kind of thing because you don't want to get caught in saying, well, nothing, everything's the same, because everything's not the same. Many things are different, but the difference hasn't it hasn't penetrated the system in the ways that it needs to, because we still have such horrible problems around poverty and issues of incarceration and education. So those are there's a lot of work left to be done, even though we are better off than we were in 1963.
Well, in 2008, with the election of Barack Obama, people thought we had entered perhaps a post-racial America, that it had ended. Now, I'm talking about white people thinking that. But the response to his presidency and the rise of just overt racism should have changed our mind on that, don't you think?
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I've been the primary leader of the Dismantling Racism workshops that we do in the Diocese of Atlanta, because the Episcopal Church requires everybody who's in a leadership position to take such workshops. And early on in that work, over the last 4 years, when I started it in 2012, people were saying, well, you know, maybe if we didn't talk about this so much, we wouldn't have a problem. But now folks have stopped that. I mean, it's clear we've got a problem. Nobody is making this up by just talking about it. There's a serious issue there. And if people have been paying attention throughout President Obama's administration, the racism stood up to be recognized a lot more vividly than it had before, because, you know, we were pretty good at pretending before. But I think there were a whole bunch of white people that just could not get over the fact that a black family had moved into the White House. I mean, that was sort of like the last straw, you know. And so people just became more honest about where they really were. And quite honestly, I prefer the honesty to the pretense.
Someone said to me, I prefer my racists out in the open.
Yes, because, you know, well, who and what you're dealing with. And when people are pretending to be one thing in your face and then stabbing you in the back, it's difficult to deal with that. But honesty, I mean, you know, you can deal with honesty. I used to tell my kids that all the time. Just tell me the truth, and then we will see what we need to do after that.
In the chapter, in one of the chapters that you wrote in the book, Living Into God's Dream, the chapter is called, Why Is This Black Woman Still Talking About Race? You write about repentance, changing one's mind. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the difference for white people and black people in regarding repentance in terms of racism?
Yes, I think that, you know, many, many white people don't understand how their skin, their white skin, gives them privileges that black people do not have. I mean, I talk to white people who came from humble beginnings, and they don't understand the concept of white privilege. But I think that because of the way we've constructed a society in this country, that if your skin is white, you have an edge, you have a step up above any person of color, and particularly black people. So one of the things that white people have to do is to begin to be more, particularly Christians, have to be more interested in being Christian than being white. And for me, that takes repentance. That takes turning yourself around, changing your mind. African Americans have internalized, I think, the whole the structure. We struggled against it. We see ourselves in the light of it. We don't want to own that because it makes us sound like we have some deficits, which we do. when you look at what's happening in our inner cities, you can see some evidence that we have internalized some negative things about ourselves. And I think African Americans have a responsibility to really own that, internalized depression, and turn away from it, turn around from it. So we've all got work to do. And I also believe that we do that work best, particularly people of faith do that work best in community with each other.
Well, yeah, I wanted to focus on that. There was a sentence in that same chapter in which you wrote, "I'm convinced that the work of dismantling racism and oppression cannot be done without great injury to the soul unless the worker has the capacity to pay attention to the ways in which the effort is supported by both the external community and the spirit within." Dismantling racism is no easy task. Can you talk a bit about paying attention to spirit?
Yes, I think that, you know, we get into the habit of thinking that in very simplistic terms about complicated issues. Race and the dismantling of racism happens to be very complicated and complex, and we want to oversimplify it. So we want to say, well, if we just do this, that'll take care of it, or if we just do that. I think that we have to look at it in the as a complex issue and an issue where we do need each other to work on this. White people need to be in relationship with black people and other people of color, and black people need to be in relationship with white people. We can't just stand on our sides of the fence and make up our minds about who people happen to be without really getting to know who they happen to be. And it's not that easy for black people to do this, because many black people don't have any opportunity to be in real relationships with white people and vice versa. So I think the internal side, the spiritual side, commands that we do that work of building relationships and also dealing with our own selves. I mean, you can't just be mindless about this. And it's not a matter of just making somebody change a law or change a rule. Laws need to be changed. You know, we do need to have the freedom to go get on the bus or go get lunch wherever we want to. But it takes more than just changing laws to get this work done.
Well, you know, oftentimes white people will ask when confronted by a workshop on racism or whatever it might be, and those the first thing, well, what can I do? What can I do? And I don't want to be too cynical, but I think, and I'm speaking personally, that question is hiding the discomfort. I don't want to hear the painful stories of race and my captivity and the wounds of it. I just want to not feel guilty and do something. Is
right.
Part of the doing of dismantling racism allowing oneself to feel this discomfort and this wound?
Absolutely, and being willing not only to feel the woundedness yourself as a white person, understanding how you got wounded by racism and the structures that have followed it, but also being willing to be in relationship with black people, or I'm just focusing on white and black because that's the biggest piece of this issue, mm-hmm. even though brown people now figure into it, but we still have more baggage around black and white than we do anybody else. And being willing as a white person to walk alongside a black person and let them and experience their journey with them without you trying to tell them what that journey is. You know, when I start telling some white people what it's like to have black sons and wonder every time they leave the house if they'll come back home alive or if they'll get killed by a police officer, you need to be willing to accept that that's my reality without trying to explain to me why I shouldn't feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, because I do feel that way, and regardless of what you think about it, it is how I feel. So white people have to become more willing to not edit the stories of black people, and we have to be willing to hear where people are. And too many times when we try to tell our story to somebody white, they have to fix it for us because it's painful and they want to get past the pain. But, you know, we have to be willing to be in the pain together.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, I'm speaking with Dr. Catherine Meeks. She's the editor of a volume called Living Into God's Dream, Dismantling Racism in America. And one of the figures that came up again and again in this volume is Howard Thurman. And Dr. Mm-hmm. King called Howard Thurman one of the most influential people in his life. What does Howard Thurman and his work mean to you?
Oh, my goodness. We don't have enough time for me to tell you, but let me tell you what I can quickly. I met Dr. Thurman before he passed away in the early 80s, and that was one of the most delightful experiences I ever had. Dr. Thurman's work is so important, and I would just encourage your listeners to read Jesus and the Disinherited and any other volumes of his that they can find. He wrote 21 books in his life, so he was a black man from Florida who really understood the necessity of finding out who you are yourself, of really understanding yourself as a child of God, and to be really focused and grounded in that faith about who you are, in order not to let the external world shape you in negative ways. And that's part of the process, I think, of getting well, period, but particularly around race, that we have to, you know, what do we bring to the equation? And you do that, he talks about all the time, about listening for the sound of the genuine in yourself, becoming an authentic person. It's difficult to do that unless you realize that that the culture doesn't define you completely. It impacts you, and you have to factor it in to your understanding of yourself. But you do have to get to the core of who you are, and that's the spiritual part. And when you get to the core, you can go out in the world to make changes and take a real person with you rather than somebody who isn't quite sure where they stand and have to fall back on things like my skin is white or I've got money or I'm powerful, because those are all illusions in many ways. And so Thurman really contributed to helping us talk about and think about, what does it mean to be an authentic person that's created in the image of God, and to stand in that faith and understanding in spite of what's happening external to yourself. And, you know, he was just the most amazing soul.
Catherine Meeks, my guest, Living Into God's Dream, Dismantling Racism in America, is a book, a collection of chapters and essays. Can you talk about the contributors to this volume? How did you select them, and what's the central contribution of each one?
Yes, well, the contributors are made up of people who are both theologians and a couple of lay people, and a social worker and a retired psychologist, and, of course, my bishop, Reverend Rob Wright from the Diocese of Atlanta. And each of these people have a great message in terms of looking at race through the lens that they have, their discipline gives to them, as well as their own journey with it. I tried to have a balance between African Americans and white people and men and women, and I feel pretty good about how that worked out. And then, of course, the foreword was written by my good friend Jim Wallace from Sojourners Community. And so what the hope is for this book is that it will create a more honest 21st century conversation about race. And I thought that all these contributors were able to offer a chapter that would help facilitate that process. And, of course, Dr. Luther Smith is a Thurman scholar, so his perspective is deeply rooted in Thurman's way of looking at things. And Dr. Loretta Coleman Brown is a psychologist and also a person who's interested in Thurman. So there's a lot of Thurman in this volume, and then other perspectives that all can be used, I think, to help people frame their own conversations in parishes and churches. The book, I hope, will be used for book studies. There's a study guide in it to help with that, because the main objective is to help people get into a real conversation about race, and a new conversation that's not, rooted in, well, aren't things better, and just those kind of oversimplified ways that we like to talk about this, but to really get into it at a deeper level.
And you serve the Diocese of Atlanta as chair of the Beloved Community Commission for Dismantling Racism, and your last chapter is about getting dismantling racism right in Atlanta. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yes. Yes. When I took over as chair of the commission, the general convention of the Episcopal Church has mandated that everybody who's a leader in the Episcopal Church has to participate in dismantling racism workshops in order to be a leader in the church. And so many people in our communion do that, don't do that as well as they need to, and our diocese was not doing it so well when I took over as chair. And one of the things I decided to do was to reorganize the workshops, so that we start with the celebration of Holy Communion. We acknowledge ourselves as people of faith and God's children, and who have a serious illness called racism, and we can work on it because we have this commitment to something bigger than ourselves. And that change has just made the work transformative, because I think the work in the church is different from the work in corporate America. And we don't need to be apologetic about our faith. We need to stand in that space and say, because we have that faith, we have the courage to do this work, because no matter how bad we feel, we have a commitment to something bigger than ourselves. And so our work has been transformed in this diocese, and we have done a lot of sharing with people across the country about what we're doing and how we're doing it. And we're moving into a whole new arena now in going forward with remembering people who were lynched in the South, primarily in Georgia. So this is another piece of the work that the commission is doing, and we keep pushing ourselves to get deeper and deeper into it, and folks are willing to go on that journey and get deeper about it, and I'm just really thrilled about that.
And as you mentioned, part of what's needed, as we were talking about Howard Thurman, is that sense of spiritual identity, that identity of what it is to be a human being that's beyond the categories of white and black, and one spiritual tradition can help in that.
That's exactly right, and the commitment has to be to something other than power and money, because that's, money and power are okay if you keep some perspective about them, but if that's your basic way of being in the world, then you've got some pretty big problems anyway. And so as people who have faith, and we've made this commitment to something bigger than ourselves, we can afford to be honest about where we are and who we are, and to realize that we're not going to throw each other away just because we got this sorry history that we're trying to overcome. And I think that's really important, because I think fear is a big reason why people don't do this work.
I want to take just a turn to politics, though, in a second. What does it mean now, positively perhaps even, negatively, with President-elect Trump in the White House and really his platform of white supremacy?
Well, it would be nice if we didn't have to deal with some of what we probably will have to deal with going forward. But in many ways, I just see this as both a challenge and an opportunity. And I think the mirror is held up for us to take a good look at who we are as a nation. We are polarized, and we have these issues that have been more underground than they are now, and that, for me, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, having honesty, having clarity about where we really are, and that we're not going to keep on acting like we're somebody we're not, those are, as far as I'm concerned, those are positive things. And I think that people who would be more likely to kind of sit back and not say anything, like for 8 years, people should have been much more upset about the way President Obama was treated than we were. But now it's like, okay, it's too bad. We can't be quiet anymore. We got to stand up and say something. So I don't find myself being as much in despair as some of my friends have been about this election. I think that that it's an opportunity, and I think that we need to get ourselves together and rise up to stand in this space and see what we need to do in response to this new administration.
Dr. Catherine Meeks has been my guest, and she's offering all of us an opportunity with her book, Living Into God's Dream, Dismantling Racism in America, a great book for a study group or an individual to begin to do the inner work and the outer work of dismantling racism. Dr. Meeks, thank you so much for this work and for spending time with me today.
Well, thank you you so much for having me. I'm deeply grateful to have this opportunity to talk.
You've been listening to Progressive Spirit. Progressive Spirit is heard weekly on stations across the country and is distributed through the Pacifica Radio Network. The website for more information and links to podcasts is progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schott. You are.
Uno para todos y todos para uno.
Community Radio is hiring for our Youth of Color Production Internship Program. This internship is open to people of color attending college and or under the age of 30. This is a 6-month internship for 20 hours a week for $20 an hour. Responsibilities include the selection and preparation of KBOO content for national distribution using a variety of digital audio workstations and helping to develop a digital content strategy for promotion of KBOO content. Deadline to apply is Friday, January 27th at 5 p.m. More information, including skills and qualifications, can be found at kboo.fm/productionintern2017.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. It's 9 a.m., and this is KBOO Portland, your community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today,